13 comes to order.
Doing five of them next week.
We have a quorum?
Yes, we do.
We do have a quorum. First on the agenda today is Senator Champion, Senate File 818. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Today, or this afternoon, you have before you Senate File 818. And this bill is really an auto title. It is really about auto title lending, which is like payday lending, except that instead of giving the lender a post-dated check or debit authorization as collateral for the loan, you give the lender the title to your car to secure the debt. Mm. Auto title lending is legal in Minnesota. Requirements our rates are for title lending are governed under the pawnbroker's law, and there are a few rules to follow. They include verifying that there are no encumbrances on the vehicle, holding the car for 90 days to allow the borrower to redeem, and several auto title lenders have obtained industrial loan and thrift licenses under Chapter 53 and have begun making loans outside of the pawnbroker statute. This loophole creates an unlevel playing field and allows some to avoid following the rules governing title loans. In 2011, more than, Madam Chair, 8,000 loans were made under law not intended to govern title lending. What this bill does and does not do, for an example, and I know that there's an author's amendment, and I would like to have someone on the committee move that shortly. But you will see once we walk through that author's amendment that it clarifies that all lenders offering the auto title loans should abide by the same rules and all other title lending, no matter what type of entity is offering it. It's also governed, just so that you know, under Minnesota Statute Chapter 325J. It does not add any new requirements. It doesn't change existing law at all. So I would love for someone to move the delete all, and I'll have Mr. Ron Elwood go through the technical elements of the amendment.
Okay, thank you, Senator Champion. Senator Reinert moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion adopted. Go ahead, Senator Champion.
Thank you. So I'll have Mr. Ron Elwood go through the amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I want to thank Senator Champion for bringing this bill forward. So the guts of the bill are in subdivisions 2 and 3. As Senator Champion mentioned, subdivision 2 really basically says everybody has to play by the same rules, and it doesn't matter whether you're a Chapter 53 lender or a Chapter 56 lender or a pawnbroker, follow the rules that have been in existence for quite some time, actually, in Section 3, Chapter 325J. The amendment, though, I think the key piece of this amendment, the most important thing that it does, is it makes crystal clear that this does not interfere in any way with anybody getting a car loan to buy a new or used car from an automobile dealer or from a bank. And we've worked with the Automobile Dealers Association and the Minnesota Bankers Association, the other banking institutions, to make sure that this works for them and that it doesn't interfere with anybody ever getting a loan to buy a new or used car. And that's the extent of the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions for the testifier? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Champion or Mr. Elwood, I notice in Subdivision 2, Item 1, you specifically call out industrial loan and thrift companies. And yet down in the exemptions, you talk about not applying to banking, credit unions, and I think up above really talking about the fact that those who are chartered and regulated by OCC or state banking regulators would be exempt, but these ILCs do in fact carry a bank charter. What do you specifically with this item? What are you looking to address, or why include someone who's got a charter versus say, an unchartered money service business like a pawnbroker, check casher, or those folks who aren't regulated.
Senator Champion?
I'll have Mr. Elwood answer that, and then I'll follow up with some information.
Madam Chair and Senator Pratt, the industrial loan and thrift institutions, traditionally, I mean, the way I like to describe them is if you've ever seen It's a Wonderful Life and you know the Bailey Savings and Loan Company, I mean, that's what an industrial loan and thrift really is supposed to be and does and has done traditionally since they were created in the early 1900s. The original ones were the Morris Plan banks. So, I mean, there's a long history. Recently, folks who are doing different types of lending and don't do the traditional ILT lending, like payday lenders, have received licenses or obtained licenses under the industrial loan and thrift. There's no requirement under the ILT statute about what type of lending it is. It's really simply the threshold, I believe, is just your net worth. So you can just go and get a license if you're a big enough entity. So this is aimed at the ILT licensees who really don't do traditional ILT lending, but who are really doing lending in a different arena, but are using this license just to follow a different set of rules. And really all this bill does is to say, if you're doing a certain type of lending, title lending, which really is very different from those other kinds of things, you ought to all follow the same rules. It's really that simple.
Senator Pratt.
You talk about being licensed through the Department of Commerce. Many of these ILCs, ILTs, are chartered in other states, and so they would have to obtain a lending license specifically to do business here, correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Pratt, it's my understanding that in order to operate as an industrial loan and thrift in Minnesota, regardless of where you're domiciled, you need to get a license from the Department of Commerce. So that's what that was intended to do or to refer to.
And Madam Chair, my understanding that this amendment is what was agreed upon with the Dealers Association. Is that right? Or the bankers? I'm sorry.
Both.
Are we going to have a testifier from the financial institutions?
Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this bill? Looks like no.
Yeah, we got.
Is there one?
You.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, Madam Chair. My name is Teresa Kuvas. I work for the Minnesota Bankers Association. We have worked with Ron Elwood and with both the authors on this, and we are in agreement that this is language that works for the banking institutions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Champion?
And Madam Chair, we have no other testifiers, and we would love for this bill to be recommended to pass and go to the Senate floor.
Okay, Senator Zoll moves. Senate file
818
as amended to Senate floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion adopted. Next, we have Senate file 1376, Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I know all our bills today are going to go this smoothly and quickly.
Well, thank you.
I thought, members, what I would do in introducing this bill and then turning it over to Peter Brickwicky from the Commerce Department is read right from our highly secretive internal notes on the bills that we have before us today. So I know our Republican members, you're always dying to know what's in these green briefs. But this is actually a really accurate summary. This is a technical cleanup bill. It originated with the Department of Commerce, relates to the Dodd-Frank and Jobs Act. It helps us conform Minnesota laws to some changes taking place at the federal level. We're not aware of opposition to the bill. The department has been working on that side. So it deals with securities, not annuities. I want to make that clear since we had that conversation on Monday. and should be a less bumpy ride than that was. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to the Department of Commerce.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwoody, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. I want to say thank you to Senator Reiner for carrying the bill. This is the Department's securities proposal. It deals with responding to changes in securities regulations made at the federal level in both the Dodd-Frank Act and the Jobs Act. The federal legislation increased states' authority in the area of investment advisor regulation by raising the threshold from $25 million in assets under management to $100 million in assets under management, and therefore regulation of the securities area has always been a partnership between the states and the federal government, but the changes made in Washington increased responsibilities for states in this regard. The bill does a number of things. It expands registration requirements for investment advisor representatives with the department. It, currently only investment advisor business entities, not the individuals, are required to register. It expands the examination oversight program, which the department began in 2012. When the department initiated the examination program in 2012, we were one of only two states in the union that did not have a program. So this would expand it through conformity with the federal regulations. It would create a new registration category for advisors to hedge funds and private equity funds, allows for merit review of proposed offerings and securities, and requires funding portals domiciled in Minnesota to be registered in order to provide more information to Minnesota consumers about products that are being offered within the state. Since the bill's introduction, visited with the chairman, obviously Senator Reinert, Senator Gazelka, and I have visited about it as well. We have been out working with folks in the investor advisor community and responded to that. Members have an amendment, I believe, that staff was passing out, which makes some technical changes to the bill, which were the result of some additional conversations we had just last week with folks in the transactional attorney world, who are highly detailed and work in this line every day, and so they suggested some things to make improvements to the bill. And perhaps turn it over to Senator Reiner.
Senator Reiner, do you want to?
Madam Chair, I would move the A2 amendment. It's an author's amendment. Members, the first half, you have the copy of it, is purely technical. Helps line this bill up with the House bill that passed out of Commerce in the House already. And the second part, as Peter mentioned, is a result of conversations they have had and includes a grandfathering clause. So I move the A2 amendment.
To that motion, the A2 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion adopted. Senator Reiner?
I think that's all we have. We're happy to answer questions, though.
And you'd like to renew your... Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, I want to thank Mr. Brickwoody, I think I said that right, for coming on this one and having a conversation. And I, unless I hear from industry people coming to the table that they're opposed, there's no reason we wouldn't want to support this.
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, thank you. I was glad to visit with you last week. The department is aware of no opposition from industry. We've had a number of conversations with folks in the securities world. I believe their Minnesota representative is in the room, but to my knowledge, they have no problems with the bill. So,
okay. Senator Reiner, do you want to?
Madam Chair, I would move adoption of Senate File 1376 and recommended passage and sent to the floor.
As amended?
As amended. Thank you.
On that motion, everyone in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion adopted. Next, we have Senate File 544. Senator Gazelka. Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair and members, this is Senate File 544. This was actually a bill that Senator Metzen was chief author of. He could not make it today. I was on the bill, and I was happy to take this bill for him. I'll just read some comments. Senate File 544 fixes an issue arising from legislation passed last session. That legislation required money transmitters such as MoneyGram and Western Union to have a fraud warning prominently displayed on the money transmission form used by customers. Mistakenly, the legislation required that the fraud warning be on all transmission forms, which includes individual to business transmission forms. This was not intended because of concern that a fraud warning on individual to business forms might be confusing to customers and wrongly implies that money sent to a business such as Excel or another utility company might involve fraud. The Department of Commerce members issued a temporary stay of enforcement to give the legislator an opportunity to correct the over-inclusive language of last year's legislation. Senate File 544 adds five words to the fraud warning provision to limit the warning requirement to individual-to-individual transmissions. And beyond that, I have Tom Johnson here that can testify as well.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Johnson with the Gray Platt Moody Law Firm, and we represent the MoneyGram International. MoneyGram and Western Union both supported the legislation last year, but caught too late the fact that it would apply to business, individual to business transmissions. And after that discovery, when it was assumed that it was only going to apply to individual transactions, we did have discussions with the authors of the legislation last year in the Department of Commerce, and the temporary stay that Senator Gazelka mentioned was issued. Just for by way of background, in the individual to business transactions, there is a pre-existing account number that the money is actually sent into, so the opportunity for fraud doesn't exist in those circumstances as it might in the individual to individual transaction.
Thank you. Members, do you have questions for the testifier? Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, you'd like to make a motion, or what would you like to
do? Madam Chair, I'd recommend that Senate 544 pass and be referred, or I'm not sure where it goes.
To the floor.
To the floor.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion adopted.
We have Senator Jensen up next with Senate File 561. Senator Jensen, I think we have a new engrossment that's going to get handed out, but if you want to begin, feel
great.
Free.
Great. That one was great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee for hearing Senate File 561. This bill makes changes to Chapter 337. It's the building and construction contracts chapter. In 1984, the Minnesota legislature adopted the anti-indemnification statute 337.02. The law prohibits agreements where one person agrees to be responsible for the injuries or damages caused by another. People must not only answer for injuries or damages that they themselves caused, they must only answer for injuries or damages that they themselves cause. We're not changing this section of the statute. At the same time, the anti-indemnification statute does permit agreements in construction contracts where one person agrees to purchase insurance for the benefit of others, and that's statute 337.05. If one person purchases the specified insurance covering another's losses, then that insurer bears the loss.
Yes, because
basically, you can't agree to be responsible for someone else's negligence, but you can agree to pay for insurance to cover someone else's negligence, creating an insurance exception or a loophole. This is a section that we're looking to change. General contractors in the construction industry have been developing and testing indemnification language in their subcontract agreements with the intent of transferring liability for the general contractor's own negligence onto its subcontractors. Frequently, these provisions require subcontractors to not only indemnify the general contractor for damages caused by defective or substandard workmanship, but also to indemnify the general contractor for the general contractor's own negligence. Now, virtually all new construction contracts require some type of broad form indemnification. The insurance loophole does not work and ultimately forces costs to the subcontractor. Subcontractors absolutely accept responsibility for their own actions, but the loophole has created a disparity
in bargaining power between contractors and subcontractors. If you don't sign the contract and take on the extra costs and the extra risks, you don't get the work. The current system forces risk down to the least able to afford it. Because most insurance policies look at loss history for 5 years, those extra costs linger years after the incident, even if the subcontractor is faultless in the claim. Ultimately, the party doing the least work is financially liable for the most risk that they cannot control. More than 15 trade associations support the bill. The Minnesota Trial Lawyers support the bill. The Insurance Federation is neutral on the bill, and I do have a letter from the Insurance Federation for the committee if they would like to take a look at that. This is the second stop for this bill. We were in judiciary yesterday, and there were a few concerns regarding unintended consequences. And what I said to the committee yesterday was that I would meet with the groups that were concerned about those unintended consequences and have conversations with them. So that's where the amendment now comes in, is the result of that work. So I would like to offer the amendment.
A3?
A3.
And senators, that's coming around. So, Senator Jensen, on this one, we probably want to wait just a second and
sure.
let folks have a look
Thank
at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe you want to talk about the amendment while it's coming out.
Sure. What this amendment does is there were three situations that were of concern. And the first one dealt with insurance policies taken out on construction, large construction projects that had one insurance company in charge of the entire project. They call them, what is it, OCP? OSIPs. What this language does, and I don't have a copy of the amendment.
It's on its way.
What this amendment does is it adds in language that it would not prohibit any agreement or contract provision to obtain project-specific insurance, and then it lists out some specifics. The other issue that was brought to our attention was that construction that happens within 50 feet of a railroad, because of the way insurance covers that area, we would have to put in some kind of an exclusion for that type of work. So this subdivision does not apply to building and construction contracts for work within 50 feet of public or private railroads or railroads regulated by the Federal Railroad Administration. So that's the areas that this amendment covers.
To be clear, this is your author's amendment as a result from your hearing previous, right?
That's correct.
All right. Do you want to move your amendment, Senator Jensen?
Yes, I would like to move the A3 amendment.
All those in favor, signify okay. by Senator Latz.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just for clarity, technically it's not an author's amendment in the traditional sense of the word because it's not the first committee the bill's been heard in, so we need to judge the amendment on its merits. And I had a technical correction, but also a question about it. On line 9 of the amendment, it says line 15 is being amended, but there's no line 15 on the underlying bill.
There's a newer engrossment of this as a result of judiciary yesterday.
Has it been handed out?
We only got it at noon.
We should probably maybe hold off and listen to
some members. So we don't even have the engrossment that's being amended at this point?
That's correct.
So he's off looking for it, right?
Madam Chair, my understanding is the page went looking for it about 10 minutes ago, and it does exist. It has not been photocopied and distributed yet. So it might be appropriate to set this aside until the members can engross.
Here it comes.
There it is. All right.
Phew.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Latz.
While it's being handed out, I could ask a question.
Please do.
On the substance of the amendment. Senator Jensen?
Yes. Senator Latz.
There was a lot of discussion in judiciary about this, and I appreciate your work and the work of the others interested in it. With this amendment, are you indicating then that the general contractors are in support of the bill, or that all of their objections have been removed? or just that some of their technical concerns have been addressed, so it's not as bad as they thought it was going to be.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, what I addressed with meeting with the interested parties was the unintended consequences that came up during the committee meeting. This addresses the unintended consequences. This does not address issues that came up in regards to people that were not in favor of the intent of the bill. So the intent of the bill is still the same, requiring everyone involved in a construction project to take responsibility for their own negligence with their own insurance.
Okay, so, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, so are you in a position to represent what the position is now of the general contractors or those who testified in opposition to the bill in judiciary?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I believe that there will be testimony in opposition to the intent of the bill, not to the amendment or to anything that has been done since, but there is still some opposition to the bill itself, the original, what we're trying to do in this bill.
Okay.
And I believe they're going to testify yep. today,
Latz,
so you'll have an opportunity.
We know of five testifiers in addition to Senator
okay.
Johnson.
Okay, so. Thank you. And just to be clear, I actually support the underlying bill, but given all the conversation we had in judiciary yesterday, I wanted to be clear
yes.
exactly what the impact of the amendment was on the whole scope of the bill. Thank you.
And members, we should now have the updated, the first engrossment with the amendment. I think that was added on in judiciary yesterday. You can see it slightly changes a line number. So the A3 amendment, Mr. Stang has confirmed, is drafted to the first engrossment. So we should have all the copies we want in front of us now. So any discussion on the A3 amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Jensen, do you have...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have with me today Kurt Smith, and he would like to speak to some portions of the
Welcome,
bill.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Smith. I'm an attorney. I am the chapter attorney for the Minnesota Subcontractors Association, and we are very much in support of this bill, as well as, I believe, 18 other specialty trade subcontractor organizations. Who quite honestly perform most of the construction work on construction projects in the state of Minnesota. Senator Jensen has done a very good job of describing the purpose of this bill, what it does in the background, so I won't repeat that. What I do want to address are issues that have been raised in other hearings by those in opposition, as well as to reemphasize the narrowness of what we're attempting to do here. This bill is meant to close what we consider to be a loophole in the anti-indemnity statute, a loophole which essentially allows a general contractor, or sometimes even an owner, to avoid the clear requirements of the anti-indemnity statute by requiring a lower tier participant, typically a subcontractor, to purchase insurance by contract, to purchase insurance to cover that general contractor's or that owner's own independent acts of negligence. What we are not doing here, and which I think is clear from the language of this bill, is we are not attempting to avoid responsibility for our own fault or mistakes. Subcontractors are ready, willing, and able to respond for their own liability. They don't want to pay for the liability of others, however. We are not attempting to prohibit contract provisions which require subcontractors, for example, to name a general contractor as an additional insured on their policy of insurance to cover the general contractor's potential vicarious liability, which the general contractor may have for work of the subcontractor. Because, again, the language of the bill is very narrow. It only prohibits contract provisions which require a subcontractor to purchase insurance to cover the general contractor's own independent acts of negligence. We also, and Senator Jensen, through the amendment here, have addressed some what others thought were unintended consequences. We never had any intention, nor did we believe the original bill did, but to clarify it, affected what are known as wrap-ups or project policies, which is why you get a fair amount of insurance jargon in the amendment about owners and contractors' protective insurance, which is a type of policy that covers an entire project, or builder's risk insurance, which is in the nature of first-party property insurance on a construction project, similar to your own homeowner's insurance, which covers your own home from loss or damage. And so we've addressed all of those in this bill and in the amendment. The bill has been around for a couple of years, and we've worked with a number of folks and reached these accommodations also on the railroad issue. The argument has been made that the situation we have today, which allows and in fact has become the norm of subcontractors having to insure general contractors for their own fault, has worked well for 30 years since the adoption of the anti-indemnity statute. And our response to that is very simple. It's worked well for the general contractors. It hasn't worked well for the subcontractors who, as Senator Jensen indicated, are the ones who at the end of the day are bearing the cost of the fault of others through increased insurance premiums when their insurance companies have to either defend or pay claims brought against a general contractor for work or for fault that was not caused by the subcontractor. We're willing to pay for our own fault. We're willing to pay for insurance to cover our errors and omissions. We are not, we do not want to pay for that of others, and that's simply very straightforward what we're trying to accomplish here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Senator Jensen, do you have any other testifiers? Otherwise, I'll start down the list.
Yes, I do. This is Doug Speedling.
Okay. And just so everyone knows, I've got Doug, I've got Bill Strusinski, Gary Thaden, Matthew Marquis, Patrick Hines, Al Gerhart, Mark Becker, Carl Cummins. So I just invite people, if you feel like your points were covered by another speaker and don't have to come to the podium, that'd be welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll be quick. My name is Doug Speedling. I'm a carpenter contractor from Hastings, Minnesota. I've been in business since 1979. Today I employ about 40 carpenters. Our work is to supply labor, follow the plan, the specs, and the direction of the general contractor. In the past 2 years, I've been brought into 7 of these claims. In one of these claims, I should say, each one of these claims cost me $1,000 deductible. I have to manage the claim, read it, follow through. In one of these claims, I was deposed for 5 hours with 7 attorneys present. That claim cost my insurance company a fair amount of money. Keep in mind, I have done nothing wrong. In all of these claims, I asked my insurance company, why are we here? I have nothing wrong. And the attorney for my insurance company that defends me says you've signed a broad form indemnity form. If I don't sign these contracts, I don't work. They're in every contract out there. I run a really good carpenter contracting company. I have a 0.8 work comp mod that's 20% under. I just finished another OSHA inspection with 18 carpenters on site. There was not one thing wrong. If I say no to signing these broad form contracts, I don't work. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Strusinski. And then Mr. Thaden, you'll be up next.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bill Strusinski, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Electrical Contractors Association, there are 700 members basically scattered throughout greater Minnesota. Small contractors, we are hugely in favor of this bill. I think it's the right thing to do. We're happy to participate in our own risk, our own liability for the things we do in our project. We've been working on some contractor issues for a number of years here. We think this is a very important bill to your small rural electrical contractors. And if you allow me the indulgence for just 1 minute, if you can imagine a more charming and better looking Gary Thaden, I just want you to know that the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Mechanical Contractors Association also support this legislation.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate the twofer. Mr. Marquis?
Is Gary here? He said that.
How about Mr. Hines? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. First, I'd like to thank Senator Jensen. She has met with the League of Minnesota Cities on two occasions to discuss our concerns. We appreciate that and hope that we may have further opportunity to work on those concerns. The amendment that she offered is fine as far as it goes from the League's perspective. However, it doesn't address the League's primary concern. And most of the testimony has been about the relationship between subcontractors and contractors. I'd like to talk briefly about the relationship between the owners, in this case cities, and the general contractors. This bill also affects the contractual relationship between generals and a city. And a city hires a general contractor for its expertise to manage the project, to hire the subcontractors. Essentially, the general takes it on as his contract. And we therefore feel it's appropriate for a general contractor to indemnify an owner, including for an owner's negligence. Owners are generally not on the project. We don't participate on a day-to-day basis. Yet in litigation, it is quite possible that a negligence claim against an owner is made, and it is good practice for that risk and that insurance to be aggregated with the general contractor. That agreement is well known at the beginning of a project. A general contractor can readily obtain this insurance. They can incorporate that into their bid costs. And we don't believe there's the disparity in bargaining position that the subcontractors have mentioned between subs and generals. These are generally larger general contractors and cities, and they can negotiate agreements to insure this way. And we had requested an exemption for political subdivisions entering into contracts with general contractors. I haven't brought that amendment forward today. I understand that Senator Jensen was willing to address concerns of ours, of the State Bar Association and others as it went through the process. But I did want to raise those concerns with the committee today and just underscore we do think there's a distinction between the upper-level relationship between a city and a general contractor and what's been discussed today. Thank you.
Mr. Hines, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, let's say this goes through as we have it before us. The city has their own insurance as well, and will that not pick up for the city and cover their potential liability exposure?
Mr. Hines?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka. And cities do maintain their own liability insurance. So if a city was sued, we would have to likely tender that to our general liability insurance. Obviously, that incurs costs for the city and that insurance. And in the same way that the subcontractors are concerned that claims made against them where they didn't have any fault will increase their insurance premiums, owners have the same concern, where if we haven't been involved on a day-to-day basis on a construction project and we get sued, that cost is being borne by the cities and ultimately by the taxpayers.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Next, we have Al Gerhart from Cross Anderson. Al will be followed by Mark Becker and then Carl Cummins. Welcome, Mr. Gerhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives of the committee. My name is Al Gerhart. I'm Chief Operating Officer for Krauss Anderson Construction. I've spent my entire 32 career at Krauss Anderson, and in preparing for today's testimony, I contacted five or six of the other more significant general contractors in town to get their opinion on the legislation that's proposed under Senate File 561, and I was unable to find a single general contractor that would support this bill. We've been headquartered in Minneapolis for 116 years and have been a Minnesota corporation. Annually, we sign more than 300 owner contracts in a year, and more than 3,500 subcontracts are negotiated. Despite our commitment to safety and quality, there are inherent risks associated with the construction industry and do present some challenges to the entire team. For 30 years, the construction industry in Minnesota, including project owners, design professionals, general contractors, and subcontractors, have successfully completed construction projects in the state under a system that allows for an effective and efficient allocation of risk associated with construction work, a system by which owners ask general contractors to indemnify them and name them as additional insured for claims that arise out of the work. In turn, general contractors require each subcontractor on the project to indemnify them and name a general contractor as an additional insured under their policy for things that arise out of their work. And it is limited to things that arise out of their work. In most cases, general contractors do not perform the work. That is performed by trade contractors under hired and employed under subcontractors. The effect of this arrangement is that the party who actually performs the work, that being the subcontractor, is in the best position to guard against the risk. And the one, therefore, that is charged with the responsibility of insuring against a claim that arises out of that subcontractor's work. Getting one insurer to cover this risk is the most cost-effective and efficient means and is good public policy. I'm here today to tell you that the current indemnity statute is fair and that all parties, owners, design professionals, general contractors, and subs all understand the indemnity insurance principles. The insurance is readily available in the marketplace for all subcontractors who are in good standing and have a good quality and safety program. The indemnity principles provide us all with an effective means to price the cost of allocating or accepting the risk through insurance and the cost for which is charged to the project as a part of their bid. We are not strong-arming subcontractors to accept unreasonable terms and conditions. All they have to do is say no. They don't have to accept the risk profile that's offered to them. There are many subcontractors who may be more experienced in the industry who could. We do this same kind of thing with our owners every day. If the project is too risky, we just say no. We are all professionals in the business. We are in an equal bargaining position, and we understand the inherent risk associated with contracts and their risk allocation. The current indemnity model has served the construction industry well for 30-plus years. The system is not broken. It continues to serve us well. The legislature got it right when it established the current statute, as it is the most cost-effective and efficient means to manage the risk. Changing the system is going to confuse the market. It's going to increase the cost of construction, requiring multiple parties to insure against the same risk on a project, and increase litigation costs. For the good of the industry and for good public policy, we would suggest that this bill not be passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gerhart. We do have some questions. I have a question. I'm trying to think of how Senator Latz framed this early in this discussion. He gave us three choices about how people might feel about the amendment that we started off with. And my sense was, coming in, talking to some folks who share a similar viewpoint, that it was probably option C, that the amendment maybe makes it less offensive.
That is correct.
Okay.
The amendment makes progress, but it doesn't get us all the way there.
All right. So,
Gazalka.
Gazalka. Senator Gazalka.
Mr. Bob, that's okay. But no, I do that all the time, too. No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerhardt, first of all, let me say I appreciate the work that Krauss Anderson has done in Minnesota. I think it's a great company. But I heard the testimony of Mr. Smith, I believe it was, for subcontractors, and they're saying we don't mind being liable for our own mistakes. It's beyond that they don't want to be liable. And if we pass that cost on to them, it means they're paying more. And typically they're often the potential to be much smaller contractors, and they don't have the means that a bigger general contractor would have. And up in the Brainerd Lakes area, I got a number of letters from small contractors in my area that I have a lot of confidence in and trust, saying this is onerous to us. You guys should change this. This is something that, you know, we feel is unfair and is driving up our cost. And like I said, I come back to they said they are more than willing to be liable for their own mistakes, but they don't want to be liable for others. And so I'm just trying to get a handle on, from your perspective, why you think that that's appropriate for them.
Mr. Gerhardt.
Thank you, Senator. I think our position on that would be, again, this is the most cost-effective means by which to manage that cost. That cost is going to reside someplace. The most cost-effective way is to assign that responsibility to the person who has the best opportunity to control it. They are the ones who are performing the work, and the cost for that insurance is going to have to be bared someplace for the risk associated with those kinds of claims. And the industry believes that having one insurer cover that risk for multiple parties is a more cost-effective means to do that.
Senator Goodwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't it the job of the general contractor to oversee the work of all the subcontractors to make sure that they're doing the job appropriately? I mean, isn't that what the general contractor is getting paid to do?
That's correct.
So wouldn't you then, if they're doing their job, the general contractors, then they should be able to control the outcome of the project and whether or not there's shoddy work or good work, and should be able to deal with those subcontractors at that time and not suffer a lawsuit later. I know, you know, we've had general contractors on some jobs that that we've had done, and they didn't watch the subcontractors, and then later on there were problems. And so really it seems to me that the responsibility lies with the general contractor that's getting paid the big money for the job compared to each subcontractor, I'm saying. How can you not think that that's your responsibility, and how can it not be the individual subcontractor's responsibility if, say, the windows were put in wrong or the roof was put on wrong, and then it should be the roofer's expense, and maybe you didn't catch it, but that's partly your problem, too, I'm sorry to say, but it is. And so then the subcontractor, the roofer, has to pay, and his insurance or her insurance rates are going to go up. So you're saying that their insurance rates should go up, even if you're making the mistake of not observing the property appropriately and the subcontractor is not responsible in any way, shape, or form for the loss.
Mr. Gerhardt?
Senator Goodwin, Mr. Chair, it is first and foremost, we believe, the party who is actually performing the work has the primary responsibility to do the job properly. Our responsibility to supervise and catch their mistakes is first a material breach of their primary duty to perform on the job. We do have the responsibility to supervise, but there are thousands and thousands of details that we watch on a project that are allocated to each subcontractor, and it is their primary responsibility to do it correct first, our responsibility to supervise second. Therefore, we ask them to buy the insurance, which they are in the best place to manage the risk on, and insure both of us for that risk.
Senator Latz.
Thank you. I have a question for the bill's author and then a question for Mr. Gerhardt. Did the amendment take care of the issue, and maybe this goes back to Mr. Hines' comment as well, did the amendment take care of the issue relating to a general contractor naming an owner as an insured, an additional insured on their policy, or did it not cover that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz.
Senator Jensen.
The amendment dealt with, like I said, some unintended consequences. What it did not deal with was this idea that we needed to include an owner in the ability and exempt the owner from being able to do the same thing that the generals are currently doing now to the subcontractors. The essence and the intent of this bill is for every person involved with a construction project carry their insurance for their own negligence and be responsible for that negligence through their insurance and have that defense be with their own insurance for their own negligence. If we carve out exceptions for individual people and allow them to pass that on to the general, that's not what this bill is intending to do. This bill is intending to stop that practice because we believe that it is a bad practice, a bad policy to expect people to pass their own negligence on to somebody else, no matter who that is. So
then, Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, so the distinction that you're making and that the bill makes by its own language is between the question of vicarious liability and the question of liability for their own negligent acts.
That's correct.
I'm following you correctly?
That's correct.
Okay, so an owner that is named in a lawsuit only because they're the owner, not because of something they've done, is in one position. But an owner that's actually done something negligent, you want to make sure they can't force their exposure on to a subcontractor or a general contractor.
That's correct, Senator Latz.
So then the question arises, let's say, for example, when you buy a ticket to a Twins game and the stadium has been designed in such a way that a foul ball could possibly hit a fan, would the designer of the Twin Stadium have any issues relating to possible negligence in the scenario of the bill that we now have before us? This kind of fact situation came up in some brainstorming of some folks after the bill yesterday, and I'm just trying to get some clarity on it. Or would it have the effect of causing all baseball stadium designers to put netting all around so there's no chance that someone could get hit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, if I'm understanding your question, I would have to look at how it currently happens. And if the designer is found at fault for some of their work, what we're saying is they should carry the insurance, and their insurance and their insurer should pay for that defense and for those situations.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Latz.
And then I have a question or two for Mr. Gerhardt. You had raised a question in your comments, sir, about not being able to have one insurer. And it's the same comment that you made yesterday in Judiciary. Did the amendment address that concern of yours?
No, Senator Latz. We would expect that
Mr. Gerhardt.
We would have – I'm sorry. We would expect that that a single insurer would cover the risk of multiple parties. That continues to be our position.
Senator Latz, any follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to interpret the amendment, and it looked to me like they had project-specific insurance provisions that might address that.
If your question, Senator Latz, Chairman, if your question is regarding the OSIP and CSIP provisions that would allow a general contractor to buy insurance or an owner to buy insurance for multiple parties on a project, the amendment did address that and satisfy our concerns there.
Good, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Thank you. Mr. Gerhardt, but it did not address the question of your ability to push onto subcontractors the cost of insurance for general contractor liability. So let me try to get this clear as well. You raised what I thought sounded like a vicarious liability question, whereby the subcontractor's negligence could result in the general contractor's obligation to pay damages, not because the GC did anything wrong, but by virtue of the fact that they're the GC.
Mr. Gary Hartman.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Senator Latz, that's correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Gerhart, help me understand why the bill, which prohibits you from passing along the costs of your own negligence, in any way interferes with your ability to pass on a vicarious liability provision.
Mr. Gerhart?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Latz, I'm not sure I fully understand your question, but we would, in some situations, have vicarious liability. In other situations, it may be alleged that we have greater than vicarious liability. And in those cases, and I don't express to be a lawyer here and have a clear definition of where that line is, but I know that in some cases it gets fuzzy. We would expect that insurance would cover us in both situations of vicarious and actual contributory or in some fashion, however minor it may be, negligence.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Gerhart, I thought the principle you were expounding was that you wanted to have the party that was in a position to prevent the negligent conduct bear the costs of insuring against that conduct. Yet you also just said you want the party that's not in a position to prevent that negligent conduct, namely the general contractor's negligent conduct, still bear the cost. So why should the subcontractor bear the cost of insuring against the general contractor's own negligence?
Mr. Gerhart.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, because it's the most cost-effective way in the industry to deal with that challenge, there is always going to be some form of contributory liability or negligence in the construction industry. Someone will make the claim that we should have done a better job of supervising. And we would believe that one insurer would be better, the industry would be better served to have one insurer taking on that complete liability for the consequences arising out of that defective work in that particular case.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz, we do have several more testifiers.
Sorry, I'll just one last question then. So do the general contractors, since you like to have just one insurer deal with this, do the general contractors in some way financially contribute to the subcontractors' costs of insuring the general contractor's negligence? Or have you simply passed the costs on and not offered to help pick up the costs?
Mr.
Chair, Senator Latz, that is included as part of their proposal when they propose on a project. We ask them to provide insurance for this peril and include those costs as part of their bid. So they pass the costs on to the general contractor, to the owner. Ultimately, the project pays the cost, and we believe that's the most cost-effective way to deal with the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Mr. Gerhart, our next testifier is Mark Becker, and Mark will be followed by Carl Cummins. And Mr. Smith, if you don't have to stay at the table if you don't want to.
He can stay.
Mr. Chairman? My name is Mark Becker. I'm an attorney in private practice. I'm a part of the construction section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. I'm on the section council. Just want to inform you that we had the opportunity to meet with Senator Jensen this morning to discuss her current amendment that is intended to deal with the unintended consequences that were identified by concerns of our organization. I think substantial progress has been made in that regard, and we look forward to working with Senator Jensen and others interested in this bill to get the best possible language to address those possible or real unintended consequences. I was encouraged to hear from Mr. Smith that it is not the intent of the bill exclude additional insured endorsements. We heard that. That was a very important point that our body found to be significant. And then I think there's been a lot of debate already about the issue of vicarious liability versus partial liability versus full negligence. And so we look forward to discussing those concerns as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Mr. Crimmins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm here representing the plumbing, heating, and cooling contractors in the state of Minnesota. We have hundreds of contractors throughout rural and metro Minnesota, and we're here to testify in support of this bill. We think it's time that the subcontractors get a fair shake and they don't have to incur extra costs, which is always passed on to the consumer as well as to the state on projects. This is just adding cost on top of cost. So we speak in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Crimmins, we have a question. Senator Letts.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Crimmins, how do you respond to Mr. Gerhardt's suggestion that the cost of the insurance is simply it's included in the bid and gets embedded in the award of the contract? It's covered by the contract, even if the party responsible for obtaining the insurance is a subcontractor. Does it end up being taken out of the subcontractor's bottom line, or is it in fact a cost that is just passed on to the overall cost of the project up the chain, if you will?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, sometimes it's just passed on, and other times, to be competitive, the contractor may have to pull that cost and bear it out of his bottom line in order to win a contract, because as we know, with the economy the way it's been in the past few years, bidding is very tight and contractors are looking for any avenue they can to have the low responsible bid.
So,
Senator Lyons.
Mr. Crimmins, might a solution to this be to somehow separate out as a line item the cost of providing that more general insurance, so that it's not a cost that's necessarily borne by the subcontractors, but rather gets allocated in some way as a separate item, and the subs are not forced to bury it in their own or absorb it in their own cost structure?
Mr. Crimmins.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I'll defer to the senator and the
Actually,
author.
Actually, Mr. Smith would like to address your question, if that's all right.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, I think the issue is one of timing. And let me just give you the example of how this works in the real world. A subcontractor bids on a project today and includes in his or her bid what his insurance cost is today. Project gets built tomorrow. A year from now, there's an incident, an accident, whatever it is, that gives rise to the claim. The claim is brought a year, two, three, 4 years later, at which time the subcontractor's insurance company then incurs the cost of defending and perhaps paying. And in the situation it is today, the cost of defending and paying for the general contractor's share of that liability. When that is all done, maybe 2 years later, I've lost track of how many years we are down the road, the subcontractor's insurance company then will reevaluate the rate that they charge. And because subcontractors' insurance, their liability insurance, much like their workers' comp insurance, is directly tied to their experience. And the problem we have is they're being charged for the experience of the general contractor who they've sued, not just their own, but there's this timing delay. And so 4 or 5 years later, the impact of the increased insurance cost comes home to the subcontractor in the way of increased premiums they couldn't have foreseen 5 years earlier when they bid that project. So it's a timing issue, Senator, that really makes that much more difficult than it would appear on its face.
Thank you. Senator Jensen, any other testifiers that you know of? That's our list. Anyone in the audience that
wants to get in a word on this before we turn it into member discussion? All right. Members' discussion on Senate File 561. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jensen, I just want to thank you for carrying this legislation. I carried similar legislation the last 2 years, and I believe Senator rested prior to me. So while this probably isn't the final solution, you're making progress, we're making progress. So I'm happy to see that, and I'm going to be in support of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Brown.
Members, other discussion? Any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a vote. Senator Jensen, what's your motion on the bill?
Yes, I'd like to recommend Senate File 561 to pass out of this committee and go to the Senate floor.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you, Senator Ring.
Senator Latz?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, I thought when left judiciary, the understanding
you need
was
to go
that
back.
It would return to judiciary because of all the unanswered questions.
Sorry,
that committee
Senator.
Had.
That's okay. Correct, Senator Latz.
And we will commit to hearing it.
Thank
so,
you.
Senator Jensen, the motion is to refer to judiciary as amended.
That's
recommended
correct.
To pass, refer to judiciary as amended.
That's correct.
All right, thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
thank you, Senator Jensen. Next on the agenda is Senate File 554, Senator Tomasoni. No, he was here. Senator Tomasoni, your timing is perfect. I'm sure you were out in the hallway just listening, waiting, biting your nails.
Ready to make a motion.
All that legalese stuff was very intriguing.
Senator Tomasoni, welcome to Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this bill is non-controversial, Mr.
Oh,
Chairman.
Oh, right. Yeah. Everyone testifying is here to say how much they love it.
Mr. Chairman, I think the best way to start is there's an A3 amendment, and I think I should put the bill in the form I'd like you to deal with it on.
Mm-hmm. Senator, the A3 amendment's coming around if you want to talk about it while it's being handed out.
I'll move it.
Basically, what this amendment does is it removes the sporting events, exhibition shows, and theatrical performances from the bill, and it increases the size of the venue from 1,000 to 5,000. And it also takes out the State Agriculture Society, the Minnesota State High School League, its members, the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, or a person involved in facilitating ticket resale. So it, those are the what it basically limits the bill to. I think
Who's
just
the center of the State Ag Society
concerts.
Would be the state fair,
huh?
Right? The State Ag Society would be the state fair.
Yes.
Members, discussion, questions on the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. Senator Tomasoni?
So, Mr. Chairman, Senate File 554 as amended is a...
Hold on, Senator Tomasoni. I think somebody actually needs to move your amendment on the committee. Is anybody willing to move the A3 amendment for Senator Tomasoni?
So
Senator Brown moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion, the amendment passes. Senator Pappas. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I was thinking that maybe you did things a little differently here, but I kind of like the way you were doing it, so that was I didn't want to object to it. Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senate File 554 is amended now as a the bill's intended to shed some light on the business practices of an industry that we hear a lot about, and it's also to provide our public with some consumer protections when they're purchasing tickets to their favorite concerts and shows. What the bill's trying to solve is that we've all heard stories about concert tickets selling out in 5 minutes. Where do the tickets go? Some of the venues and Ticketmaster, owned by Live Nation, tell us that many of the tickets get scooped up by scalpers using computerized bot software. Others, particularly involved in the secondary market, contend that they often only a small percentage of the tickets are actually offered to the general public by promoters, and that is why the tickets sell out in 5 minutes, which is a relatively small supply for an event that is in high demand. So you might ask, why should the public have the right to know the information? It's because most of these venues have been financed and paid for by Minnesota taxpayers to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, and giving consumers more information so that they can make more informed purchasing decisions is a small price to pay. I can have somebody run through the sections of the bill if you would like, Mr. Chairman. Would you like me to do that as is?
Your preference, Senator Thomasoni, many of us are familiar with the bill from previous commerce, but not everyone.
If you're comfortable with me not running through the provisions, then I will let you go ahead with some witnesses if you want.
Thank you, Senator Thomasoni. We do have a few witnesses or folks that want to testify. We'll start with John Braille from the National Consumer League, and John will be followed by Abdul Kamara. And testifiers, since we have a few, if you just, Abdul, if you want to come on up and take the other empty seat. So, John.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Brio, and I'm the Vice President of Public Policy, Telecommunications, and Fraud with the National Consumers League. I appreciate this opportunity to appear before the committee to speak in support of SF number 554, and I applaud you for considering this pro-consumer bill. Founded in 1899, NCL is the nation's pioneering consumer organization. Our nonprofit mission is to advocate on behalf of consumers and workers in the United States and abroad. In 2009, we led a coalition of consumer organizations, independent businesses, and more than 10,000 grassroots supporters in opposition to the Ticketmaster Live Nation merger. Today, we continue to advocate on behalf of ticket-buying consumers nationwide. The live event market today, as you mentioned, operates in a largely opaque environment that leaves consumers at the mercy of ticket sellers, artist management companies, promoters, and venue owners. While we can do little about add-on fees like printed home fees, we do not believe that companies like Ticketmaster and their clients should have free rein to surreptitiously distort the supply of tickets available to the general public. They're able to do this through a little publicized but widespread industry practice known as holdbacks or allocations. We believe that this practice plays a significant role in the scarcity of face value tickets for the general public. As such, NCL is a strong supporter of increased transparency requirements on primary ticket sellers so that consumers know how many tickets are being made available for general sale. A recent example of the widespread nature of the holdback problem was Justin Bieber's January 18th show in Nashville, Tennessee. According to an investigation by WVTF-TV in Nashville, 90% of the tickets for Bieber's January 18th show in that city were set aside for special interest groups. And Bieber isn't the only guilty party. Only 16% of nearly 17,000 seats for a concert by Pink at the Izod Center in New Jersey this month were made available. At a February 2013 concert for Maroon 5, also in New Jersey, only 32% of the tickets were made available for public sale. Similar incidents have occurred during tours for stars Taylor Swift, Keith Urban, Miley Cyrus, and Katy Perry. Make no mistake, this is a practice that almost certainly occurs in Minnesota as well. Indeed, the publicly financed Target Center here in Minneapolis last year denied a Minnesota Data Practices Act request for information on this practice on the grounds that information was, quote-unquote, a trade secret. We believe that the concert industry's use of undisclosed holdbacks is wrong and penalizes consumers three times over. First, it hurts consumers who have spent their personal time trying to buy a small number of tickets under the erroneous assumption that they have a chance at most of the seats in a venue. It hurts those consumers a second time when they then can't buy the ticket they are seeking, so they are forced to go to the secondary market and pay inflated prices for tickets based on the hype created by the artificially engineered sellout. And all too often, a consumer who just does pay a premium for a ticket on the secondary market is hurt a third time when the tickets to the allegedly sold-out show are later made available once the show's promoters realizes that she held back too many tickets. SF number 554, which seeks to create greater transparency in the primary and secondary ticket market and protect consumers' rights, will go a long way towards addressing this problem. By requiring disclosure of the total number of tickets to be issued, as well as disclosure of the number of tickets to be made available to the general public, this bill will help address the issue of ticket holdbacks. Consumers should be made aware of their chances of getting tickets when they go on sale to the public. If they knew that a large number of tickets would be set aside for fan clubs, promoters, radio stations, and the like, they might decide to wait and see if they can buy the ticket on the secondary market at face value or less. All of it is a risky proposition for the typical consumer who has very little power over the market because there is so little information available about how that ticket market operates. The consumer protections in this bill will also give consumers additional confidence in the marketplace for tickets. By requiring ticket issuers, ticket brokers, and secondary ticket exchange operators to provide refunds, a toll-free customer service number, and third-party dispute resolution services, Minnesotans will be better protected when they purchase a ticket to a live event. In conclusion, the National Consumers League supports efforts to make the live event market more transparent and consumer-friendly. SF 554 will ensure that that consumers benefit from increased transparency and the consumer protections that give them greater confidence when buying tickets. Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving the National Consumers League this opportunity to speak in support of the pro-consumer bill. We applaud your leadership in this area and look forward to answering any questions you or other members of the committee may have.
Thank you. Members, do you have questions for the testifier? Senator Tomasoni? Next testifier. State your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Abdul Kamara, and I live in Oakdale, Minnesota, and I'm just an everyday Minnesota fan. I love to go to outdoor concerts like many of my fellow Minnesotans. The problem is that people don't know how few tickets are actually available for purchase. I think people have that right to know as consumers, and I would urge you to support Senate File 554, which would require venues to disclose this information. Now, when an artist comes to perform at such a massive venue like the Target Center or Excel Center, I assume that they have a decent chance of actually, you know, I have a decent chance of getting a ticket, and other consumers have a decent chance of getting a ticket, given how many seats are actually available, apparently. But this is not the case in reality. Frequently, thousands of these tickets are saved for VIPs, fan club, premium credit card sales, pre-sales, which actually reduce the number of tickets available to everyday fans like myself. Now, we as fans have the right to an open and transparent ticketing industry in Minnesota. I also think that we as fans have a right to know when our favorite artists come and they're withholding tickets, large quantities of tickets, from sale to scalp on the secondary market for profit. The reason is because this takes away tickets from ordinary fans like myself. Now, fans should know that are just like me that this is happening when it does occur. Now, many times in many states, consumer protection laws require that when a company advertises a product, that they must supply a demand that will meet what the customers are looking for. Now, if they don't have a sufficient supply, they are often required to inform the public. Now, the concept is the exact same. Ticket agencies and venues should be held to those same standards as other companies are. Now, given that these shows rapidly sell out, sometimes within seconds, the supply clearly doesn't match that demand. Therefore, the number of available tickets should be available and always be public knowledge. Now, lack of transparency undermines my rights and other consumer rights in Minnesota, and it inhibits consumer access. We as fans always depend on the assumption that when there's a lot of seats at a venue, there's going to be a lot of tickets for sale, and we deserve the right to be informed if this is not the case. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I ask you to please urge, I urge you to support the Senate File 554 and to support Minnesota fans' right to know. Thank you for your time.
Members, any questions? Senator Tomasoni,
well,
you have more other testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's other testifiers. Yes.
Joe Wright. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, woman, and rest of members of the committee. My name is Peter Moe. I'm a freshman at the University of St. Thomas, and I came here to speak out in support of Senate File 554. Being a socially active 18-year-old and a fan of all the major sports teams and great music that comes to the Twin Cities, I often go to a lot of games and concerts. And Minnesota is home to some of the greatest venues, not just the country, but the world. We have the Xcel Energy Center just a few blocks away, Target Field in downtown Minneapolis, and soon to be constructed and opened, the future Viking Stadium. And what do all these venues have in common? They're paid for by tax dollars from Minnesotans. Tax dollars paid for by everybody in this room. And I feel that as a taxpayer, I should be able to find out how many tickets are available for a game or for a concert or some sort of event. But the problem is that many ticket sellers, venues, and artists keep fans in the dark about how many tickets are available. They have many pre-sales. They hold back a lot of tickets for themselves. For example, the Beyonce show coming this summer to Minnesota, they had several pre-sales for credit cards and sponsors. And so by the time that the tickets went on sale to the general public, the amount was so small that the tickets sold out within an hour. And holdbacks like these can account for nearly 90% of all tickets for an event, or concert, or game. Now, this bill is just common sense. It provides fans, ticket buyers, consumers, whoever, with the information they need to make an informed decision. Do they have a realistic shot of getting a ticket or not? And that's what we all want. It's very simple. It just requires honesty and integrity from the venues and the sellers. and it honestly doesn't infringe upon any trade secret. I don't care about who owns it. You know, do they pay for it with what credit card, what the social security numbers, where they live? I just want to know how many tickets are left and if I can get one. I don't care about how much money they make because I know they're doing pretty good. I urge every member on this committee to support this bill because it protects consumers and it supports them as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Members have any questions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Tomasoni and any of your testifiers, do you know if this this system exists in any other state?
Good. Really helpful.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Colin Sheehan, and we represent eBay, which owns StubHub. Senator Carlson, not to our knowledge, no.
Thank you.
Okay. Next on my list is Brian Luther and Ben Gerber.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Luther. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Sports and Entertainment Industry Coalition and the company that I work for, VenueWorks. VenueWorks is a company that manages arenas, theaters, and convention centers. We manage 50 venues in 20 communities in 12 states, including two properties here in Minnesota, the Sanford Center in Bemidji and the Burnsville Performing Arts Center in Burnsville. VenueWorks opposes Senate Bill 554 for two main reasons. The first is that we believe by disclosing ticket inventory, we will be putting ourselves at a competitive disadvantage in attracting major concerts to Minnesota venues. We believe that the artist's ticket holds and presale results are proprietary information. By forcing an artist to divulge this information, we will be putting ourselves at risk of losing shows in our most prized venues. The tour and concert industry is extremely competitive. It's not just the Target Center versus the XL Energy Center. We compete against other markets in other states, like Des Moines, Kansas City, Green Bay, Fargo, and Winnipeg. If we are in a competitive situation for a show in another state that does not require an artist to disclose this information, the artist will in turn choose the facility that protects their ability to conduct business in a manner they prefer, and the result will be a tremendous loss for our state. In addition to our competition, many of the facilities that qualify for this legislation are publicly owned or funded. They were constructed to create entertainment districts, jobs, and stimulate the local economy. There is a very high level of expectation from the public that these facilities are aggressive as possible to generate event content that will provide direct and indirect revenues. Any show that we would lose would have a negative impact on our part-time employees, such as stagehands, ushers, security guards, and concessionaires, not to mention the jobs impacted in surrounding areas from bars, restaurants, hotels, and parking ramps. The second reason we are opposed is that by disclosing ticket information, we will only give the ticket scalpers a competitive edge. Not just will the fans be able to see the tickets available, the scalpers will too. The scalpers will be in a position to know how successful the show will be and how aggressive they will be in purchasing tickets. If they know there are only 10,000 tickets available, they will be able to assemble a strategy to acquire as many of those tickets as possible. In closing, our concern is by making ticket inventory known to all, we are putting ourselves at risk by not getting top touring shows in our state. The legislation in front of you does not tackle the real issue, which is ticket scalping and the extreme disadvantage the fans have in purchasing tickets for face value. Remember, the proponents of this bill are StubHub and eBay. I don't believe they are proposing this legislation to help fans get tickets during public on sales at face value prices. The reality is they want to protect their ability to resell tickets and gain every advantage in doing so. This does not represent the fans' best interest. Please vote no to this legislation today, and let's turn our efforts to addressing the real issues that impede the fans' ability to purchase tickets for the great artists that perform in our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, last couple of years we've been going around and around on this issue, and the argument from those like yourself that did not want legislation to go forward, you said, you know, the scalpers are going to be getting all the tickets, and yet it seems like there's a lot more clarification now that perhaps not all of the tickets are even available to the general public, And so it's really not about the scalpers. It's more about, you know, practices that you guys are doing. And that part bugs me personally because, you know, if it was about the scalpers, this might have been a different issue. But can you give me, for example, for Beyonce, you know, I believe tickets came available at 10 a.m. Friday, February 15th. At that moment, what percentage did we even make available to the general public? Can you give me an approximate number?
You know, I don't represent the venue that Beyonce performs at, so it's really not an answer that I can give. But I will say is that, yes, there are artist holds. There are pre-sales. There are pre-sales through venue. There's pre-sales through artist fan clubs, all of which are accessible to fans. And most of the fans that frequent concerts will sign up for these opportunities. Yes, there are corporate pre-sales that take place. Again, I'm not commenting on the Beyonce show. It's not a venue that I represent. But there is tickets that are held back, and that's just been a common practice since day one in this industry.
Senator Gazelka?
Well, so Madam Chair, the testifier, so then it really isn't first about, you know, what the scalpers are going to do with that small group of tickets. It's making a decision, a business decision, about how many tickets you want to read or have available to the general public. The second thing related to that is you said that if we go this route that we're going to lose some big shows, or for lack of a better term in my mind, but if my understanding is between Chicago and the Rockies or even California, I don't know that there's in the northern part of the United States, this is a huge metropolitan market. You're telling me that they're just going to turn it away because we want to know this?
Mr. Moe?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Mr. Gerber, sorry.
No, that's him.
No.
That's why I call him testifier.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll be Mr. Luther.
Reporter, man.
You know, I think what happens is this is a definite concern from the promoters that I've talked to and promoters that are here. And last week, actually, you know, Randy Levy, leading promoter here from Rose Presents, based in the Twin Cities, spoke at the House Committee hearing last week and mentioned that, yes, there is a tremendous amount of competition, and there is a chance that shows will play other markets, and it's a very strong concern of his, which he voiced publicly, and I know from talking to other promoters that is a challenge when they're looking at bringing shows in. If the artists and the artist management feels that there could be an issue with this, they can take offers from other venues that might have the same capacity. When you look at the names of the cities that I provided, they have very large facilities that can accommodate these shows as well too. The primary message we're trying to say is we do not want to put ourselves at a competitive disadvantage, and we really want to focus on the scalping, and that is the primary concern that we have.
Senator Brown?
One more follow-up, Madam
Senator Chair. Gazelka.
Thank you. To the testifier, and that's, you know, that's where I'm bringing this issue up, is I don't think the primary issue is the scalpers, because if we're dramatically limiting the number of tickets available, and that certainly is your right, but to blame it then on the scalpers that they're taking all the tickets when we don't know the number, and it could actually be a small percentage of the tickets that of total tickets available out to the general public, well, then it isn't about the scalpers. It's about a business model, and it's either one or the other. But I just don't want the scalpers blamed for business practices that you're choosing to do.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really struggling with this bill. Could you explain to me why artists and their management would not want to disclose the number of tickets that are available to the general public?
They feel that is proprietary information. That's part of their business model, and that is what we've been working with in the last probably 30 years of the industry.
Madam Chair, and I understand that, but I'm not grasping the concept of what's so proprietary about it that they don't want the general public to know. I would just like you to walk me through.
Sure.
I'm just trying to understand why that is such a major factor for artists and management.
I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. I think that's something that really should be discussed with our promoters that frequent our facilities. And I think those are concerns that they'd be able to voice directly because they work with the artists directly. As a venue representative, I mean, we are really working with the promoters, and we allocate the tickets through our box office the way that we're being asked to.
Senator Brown.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, do we have any promoters here today that will be testifying that I can ask that question to down the road?
Yes, I don't know that.
Beyonce
but
here.
I think you're asking. she was.
Senator
I think she
Tomasoni.
Was. There was a snowstorm. But I think it's a good question, Senator Brown, because I guess if Beyonce wants to hold back 5,000 tickets for herself, So what if she tells somebody? I guess I don't understand why that's an issue either. So, you know.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Like Senator Brown, I think I'm struggling with this bill as well. When a facility asks the taxpayer, the people, to invest in the construction or renovation, aren't they then a stakeholder? I don't know that I buy the argument that they have a right to know how many tickets, just a general has a right to know how many tickets are available for sale. That's the venue's business practice, I think, as Senator Gazelka talked about. But now the people are a stakeholder. They're a partial owner, a financer of the business. Don't those stakeholders have a right to know how their business is being conducted?
I guess I'd answer that question with a question. Once a ticket buyer knows there's 10,000 tickets for sale, will that change your ability to still get those 10,000 tickets? I mean, once you understand that there's that many available, will that change it? I mean, it's difficult to say. I mean, we'd be posting audits, we'd be posting numbers on tickets and all the capacities. I just don't, I guess still kind of struggling to see what the benefit is really to the fan to know the number of available tickets.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. I'm not talking about consumer behavior. I'm talking sure. about disclosure of business practices for publicly financed facilities.
Mr. Luther?
I guess I don't have an immediate answer for that question. I mean, it's such a different concept, a different model than what we're used to working. But, again, we feel that this could put us at a disadvantage with the shows that come through that want to continue to keep that information proprietary.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomasoni, I just want to clarify something on the last question I asked. Did we determine there are no promoters here today?
Oh, no, I guess, I don't know.
There is one. Should we do that?
If there is anybody here that would want to answer that question.
Well, I don't. I just want to know if I'm going to have the opportunity later in testimony.
I guess I don't know the answer to that question, Madam Chair. Is there a promoter here that is raising their hand back there or anything?
Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm hearing that this bill could potentially have a huge impact on their business, but yet there's not a single promoter here to defend that argument. I guess that helps me make a little easier decision on this bill, but I guess I'm a little disappointed if there's not a single promoter here.
Senator Housley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomasoni, would this also apply to like Moondance Jam that happens up in Walker, that there's more than 5,000 people that come to that event and they sell more than 5,000 tickets, or WeFest?
Madam Chair, Senator Housley, that's a good question. I don't know if that's considered a state. It is. It would apply to it. Yeah. So I guess they're telling me it would apply. Yeah.
Madam Chair,
Senator Housley,
Senator Tomasoni, because I do know Moondance Jam is takes place on private property. The Belo family up there owns the property, and it's kind of their big event. So this would be affecting them, and I don't know if they would be very happy with it, I think.
Well, you know, Madam Chair and Senator Housley, I guess that's a good question. The thing that, and maybe this is a little bit of naivety on my part, but if the Eagles are coming to the XL Center and they put all the chairs on the hockey rink floor, you can probably seat 25,000 people. Now, I wouldn't be naive enough to think that there's 25,000 tickets available, because I would think that people would hold back tickets for the performers and things, but I would think just off the top of my head that there's 18,000 or 20,000 tickets available. And it's, you know, it's turning out that we're finding out that there's maybe 5,000 or 2,000 that are actually available to the general public, and they end up selling out in 5 minutes. And so I think all we're trying to get to here is that let the general public know what's available to them as far as ticket sales are concerned, and what's being held back. And that just doesn't seem to be too onerous to me. I don't know.
Mr. Gerber, did you want to testify or say something?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're an organization of about 2,400 businesses across the state of Minnesota. 80% of our businesses have actually under 21 employees, so they qualify as small businesses. We have some serious concerns about this bill. I think, you know, just to point out, I believe in your packet you have a letter. This isn't only just the business community. I believe the Teamsters Joint Council 32 has also signed onto a letter opposing this bill. And one of the things that I'd like to point out is I think using the slippery slope argument is something that I never like to do, and it always raises my alerts me when another lobbyist uses it. But I think this is one of the best examples I've ever seen of how this could be a fairly dangerous bill for the business community. We've heard a lot of talk about, the public financing. I'd like to point out, too, that there was a letter in your packet from David Balser, who I believe is the director of ticketing for the Target Center. And I think, one of his points was that one event may generate over $200,000 in sales tax revenue. So I think it was brought up, well, if the taxpayers are financing these things, shouldn't they have a say in how many tickets are allocated? But I think when you look at the payback on some of these, the public financing of these events, I think it's also in the sales tax and not just the public availability. The second thing on the slippery slope argument is there's a lot of other businesses that have that allocate tickets or for example, a hotel. There's hotels that receive public financing either at the local or state level. Are we going to require them to disclose to the public how many rooms they have and how much they're selling for? I mean, I think, there really is a huge concern about where we're gonna draw the line and where we're gonna go with this. I think also another concern that hasn't been discussed but I think should be brought up is that on line 3.30, it would, I believe, require somebody to give a refund if the ticket received by the purchaser is counterfeit, and so you're putting liability on if the person holding the event didn't sell the ticket, and you're going to require them to reimburse somebody for a counterfeit ticket. I think that there's some serious concerns with that as well. So, I think Senator Tomasoni, I know, has the best intent with this bill. I think there's some serious enough concerns that would warrant taking a closer look at this. And we did, Senator Pratt asked if there were people at least in the House hearing, there was several promoters, I believe, that spoke. And one of the things they said is, we are an important market, and Minnesota is a great state, but Nebraska and was one state that was mentioned that has facilities comparable to ours, and we tend to get that business instead of Nebraska, but it could easily go there. I mean, we have to consider that these promoters have a choice. When in the touring business, they have a choice, and they can decide where to go, and they don't have to come here. And I think that's the concern we're hearing. Another thing that I think needs to be said is sitting through some of the hearings in the House about the lockouts, and one of the things we heard is the impact on local businesses. And I'm seriously concerned that if we don't have those local acts coming to the Excel Center, to Target Field, the waitresses, the business owners, the waiters, the janitors, all these people are going to have a lot less work to do. And I think that's something that we need to be concerned about.
Okay.
With that, thank you very much.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I didn't want to cut off if there were any more testifiers, but we're ready for discussion. I guess I wanted to share my concerns when you have such a broad coalition that is opposing legislation. Even though it may sound kind of logical to us, I don't know that we know enough about the entertainment industry, about the booking industries, about all this field, these facilities that rent to these performers to really be able to make a clear decision. It was my understanding that in the House they had proposed a study that the Department of Commerce actually looks at all the impacts, because I think you're right. What is the impact of holding tickets back? What's the impact of scalpers? It'd be really useful to have that information and have input from all these venues before we make what could have serious unintended consequences. So, Senator Tomasoni, what about the approach that the House has taken to actually taking a step back and doing a study on this?
Senator Tomasoni.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I guess the what the other body does is their business, and they can do that if they want. I think this is just a simple transparency thing, and I don't exactly understand what what the big issue is for us to let the public know how many tickets are available for sale at the time of the that they go on sale. So I don't know that we need to study it. It's pretty black and white to me, but maybe I'm just not getting all this. I don't know.
Senator Pappas.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, when you have the director of ticketing from the Target Center, who I think we'd all acknowledge knows a lot more about this than we do, and other witnesses who are basically saying that this is proprietary information and that a lot of these promoters will just not come here if they have to do something that they don't have to do in other states. So I'm sympathetic with fans who, you know, can't get their tickets to their favorite event. I think that's a problem that the study could also look at, is why is that happening? Because it is true it's not fair to fans. But I'm real nervous about moving ahead with something that could have that big an impact on this industry.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomasoni, I want to address something the Chamber just mentioned, and that's on page 3. Lines 27 and lines 30, it says, provides a consumer who purchases an event ticket a full refund if, and then down on 30, the event ticket received by the purchaser is counterfeit. Is this legislation requiring the promoter to offer a refund to a ticket they didn't sell?
Madam Chair, again, Colin Sheehan. We represent eBay StubHub. Senator Brown, to your question, I think the intent of Section 3 and specifically those lines is that the event ticket received by the purchaser is counterfeit. So presumably a venue or the original ticket seller is not producing, you know, Xcel Energy Center, for example, or Ticketmaster, whoever, is not selling a counterfeit ticket. So the intent is not to, you know, force them to give back money for legitimate tickets, strictly counterfeit tickets, so it's really the point of purchase. And if there's a recommendation on cleaning that up or clarifying that, that's totally fine. So if you purchase a ticket on the secondary site, that would be your point of purchase, and that would be who owes you a refund for a counterfeit ticket.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Tomasoni? Would you like to make further comments?
No, I'm ready to move on the bill.
Ready to move on the bill. Okay. Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair, I'm just thinking the simplest solution would be to just delete line 3.30. At least I'd like to move that as a possible amendment for discussion.
Okay. Senator Gazelka makes an oral amendment, offers an oral amendment to delete lines
3.30. Why do you want to do that, Senator?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, it's flat out not clear. It's presumed that it means something, but as I read it as well, it would seem to me that if you have a counterfeit ticket, you can bring it in and get a refund. To me, it's just not clear, and I'm generally in support of this bill, but I'm concerned about something that I think could cause this, action that I don't think we should be doing.
Senator Gelsen, I think Senate Counsel can help us here.
Madam Chair, members, just an idea. How about after purchaser, insert from that person?
Yes.
Is that your motion?
That's exactly what my motion was.
Okay, good. Any further discussion?
I don't get that. I explain that.
Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair, if you look up on 3.22, it talks about what a person subject to this section shall have to do. And so I'm trying to tie it back to that person doing something that should require reimbursement. And if you're not that person that issued the ticket, you wouldn't have to give them a refund. That's at least the point of what I'm trying to do.
Senator Tomasoni, do you have
I think that's acceptable, Madam Chair.
I thought that's acceptable.
From that person after
the purchaser. Yeah. Senator Gazelka's oral amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion adopted. Senator Tomasoni.
I think we have some 2,000 petitions here in a box of people who are in favor of this, and just This is the worst writing I've ever seen in my life, so I can't read it.
But Madam Chair, again, just wanted to make a point that there are many organizations in opposition to this, and over the past several weeks, there's been over 2,000 petitions submitted to legislative leaders and the governor in support of this as well.
Thank you. Would someone like to make a motion on the bill?
I will.
Senator Goodwin?
I move that Senate File 554, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Judiciary.
Judiciary. Come on, that.
On that motion.
As per roll call.
We will have a roll call. Please take the roll. Papers.
Brown.
Yes.
Carlson.
Yes.
Dahl.
Yes.
Doms. Gazelka.
Yes.
Goodwin.
Yes.
Housley.
No.
Jensen.
Yes.
Latz.
Yes.
Pappas.
No.
Pratt.
No.
Reinert.
No.
On account of 7 ayes, 4 nays, motion adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Okay, we have Senate File 314. We're going to try to get through this before 2:30. Keep in mind. Welcome, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 314, and it essentially would require coverage of autism spectrum disorder through the private insurance. I have Jim Erickson here who's going to walk you through the bill.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm delighted to be here. My name is Jim Erickson. I'm representing, as legislative counsel, the Autism Treatment Association of Minnesota, an association representing some 11 providers of ABA treatment to the autism community. Being passed around is a number of pieces of information that I will refer to briefly that I think will help inform the testimony that we are about to give. But while that is being passed out, 4 different pieces, I'd like to take you briefly through the bill, if I might. This bill is, as Senator Eaton indicated, a simple, straightforward requirement. And yes, you can call it a mandate. It is that. And I know that to some, mandates are bad words. In this case, it is an absolutely necessary mandate to serve the autism community, the children, and their parents. 33 states have passed this bill, recognizing the need and the nature of the autism crisis that we are dealing with now. Let me, Senators, take you through the bill very quickly. Section 1 is, of course, definitions, which are fairly straightforward. The one I would point out is health plan means, in this case, as a practical matter, the big three, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Health Partners, and Medica. There are others that it applies to, but that is, they are the largest that this would apply to. And you might know that Blue Cross Blue Shield, until just December 31st of last year, did cover this and did provide coverage. The guts of this bill, if you will, the policy that is in front of this committee is found in Subdivision 2, the coverage required. A health plan must provide coverage for the diagnosis, evaluation, assessment, and medically necessary care of autism spectrum disorders, including but not limited, and on the next page is a standard and traditional list of the therapies that are applied to the autism, to someone on the ASD spectrum. I want to point out that on 2.2, the coverage required in this section shall include treatment that is in accordance with an individualized treatment plan prescribed by the insured's treating physician or a mental health professional. So we are dealing with a diagnosis made by a professional and a treatment plan diagnosed and directed by a professional. And with respect to the mandate, appropriately below that in Section C,
the health plan may not refuse to renew or reissue or otherwise terminate coverage solely because the individual is diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. I will point out that in subdivision 4, point 2.19 to 2.22, that may bear some later discussion. This bill is exactly the bill that passed the full House in 2009 and made it through this committee and another committee in 2009, only to be not in the end in the conference committee, the omnibus conference committee. So this bill has been well vetted, and we chose to bring you the language of the bill that passed in 2009 as it did. At some point in the later process in the committees that deal with the money side of this, we will have to deal with the coverage, whether this coverage is required of state employee families or is required to be covered, or the state employee program would cover them. But we, at the time they were covered in 2009, we left the same language, and now since, as of the end of last year, the state employees' families were also not covered, the legislature often make a decision as to whether this benefit would be re-extended to the families of state employees. We, of course, that's a financial issue. We, of course, support it because, to be consistent, we believe autism ought to be provided to anyone, whether through the private insurance policies or not. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the essence of this bill, and I believe that for that specific requirement, if now health plans are required to cover autism spectrum disorder, it results in a savings to the state. There are offsetting, if you choose to apply the and require that the state employee families also have that coverage, there's a cost there. You had that cost until December of 2012. Now the question is, and it was stopped and it was dropped, now the question would be whether you want to reapply that. But that's a separate issue. Let me just take you through, as the materials are coming around, some of the materials that you can reference. And we respect the committee's time. We'll take perhaps only 10 minutes to finish our testimony so you can leave time for the opponents and then answering questions. One of the packages you have is a list of our supporters. We have five testifiers listed there. We'll bring a couple of them at least on and then defer to make sure there's enough time that you can continue to hear this. There's a list of the organizations supporting this bill on that list, and then a long list of parents that are also here willing to testify. Madam Chair and members of the committee, might I ask that the folks that are here to testify on behalf of this bill simply stand up so that you can recognize the would you please stand, those of you who are here to support Senator Eaton's 314. Thank you very much. All of them would be prepared because they're intimately involved and knowledgeable to testify, but we don't want to take your time to do so. The testimony of a number of those individuals, including the listed witnesses, are attached and prepared in that document that is the witness list. So when we call forward a witness or two, you can follow their testimony, and those we don't get to, you will inform your, you can put in your file. I think if you are not familiar with ABA and autism spectrum disorder and the fact that 33 other states have done it, I would commend you to flip through this colored PowerPoint, which is prepared by Autism Speaks. Mr. Wasmer could not be here today, and I'm submitting this for the record and for your information. It answers almost every question you could have about autism coverage, the cost of requiring private insurance coverage, and again, I think it makes the case eloquently, factually, and with respect to the public policy that supports this. I also want to point out that another colored piece in the materials is a headline, California Declares Autism a Public Health Crisis. It is that, indeed. And if you need any more further discussion about that or further evidence, I want you to suggest that. As fact, we were talking to the Commerce Department here and Governor Dayton about making a similar declaration so that the point is well made and that Minnesota can catch up with the rest of the country in providing this important benefit to this important group of citizens. And the last page is a cost comparison of treating autism spectrum disorder children early in their career and not waiting to have them be burdens on the public system later on. And the cost comparisons are stunning. They are included there. Madam Chair and Senator Eaton, we would then like to call on at least a couple of our witnesses, Randall Bachman first, and then we'll see what time Senator Eaton wants to cut off our testimony and turn it back to you for points.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Erickson. And Randall Bachman, is he making his way to the table?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randall Bachman. I represent the Autism Recovery Foundation. The foundation was formed by parents, providers, and advocates who believe that every child and family with autism should have access to effective, evidence-based early intervention and treatment. We believe there's a growing body of evidence in support of effective early identification, treatment, and that treatment. With that treatment, some children do recover to the point that they can be mainstreamed with their typical peers. We strongly support Senate File 314. 33 states now require private insurance coverage for the treatment of autism, including intensive early intervention behavior therapy. It is time for Minnesota to do the same. According to the Minnesota Department of Education, the prevalence of autism in Minnesota has increased 300% since 2001. The trend is the same throughout the country, so that 1 in 88 children is now diagnosed with autism. It is a public health crisis that must be addressed by all sectors, public, private, and individual families. Unfortunately, coverage for autism treatment by the private insurance industry has regressed. The last carrier covering intensive early intervention behavior therapy for children with autism, Blue Cross Blue Shield, notified parents in 2012 that they could no longer cover this therapy in 2013. As a consequence, parents either had to drop this critical therapy for their children, go deeply in debt to continue it, or rely on taxpayer-supported public insurance to pick up the tab. The insurance industry will tell you that they do provide coverage for autism treatment. What they mean is that they provide coverage for ancillary services, such as speech and occupational therapy. They specifically do not cover intensive early intervention behavior therapy, which is the core evidence-based treatment for children with autism. The insurance industry will tell you that intensive early intervention behavior therapy is unproven. If that is the case, then why has it been endorsed by the American Academy of Pediatrics? Why is it a treatment that is covered by federal employees under their health plans? Why is it endorsed by the Agency on Healthcare Research Quality? Why was it recently acknowledged by the Minnesota Department of Human Services Healthcare Advisory Committee as an effective treatment? The insurance industry will tell you that it will add a significant cost to premiums. Experience has shown that in the states that have enacted the mandate, the actual cost was 31 cents per member per month. Each state is different and has different requirements. However, it is our assertion that in Minnesota, if this legislation were adopted, it would add no more than a dollar to the per member per month cost of the premiums. The truth is that if private insurance sector does not do its fair share in supporting this medically necessary treatment, the cost will be shifted to the taxpayer. We've already seen this shift occurring as parents lose their coverage and must either go deeply in debt to continue critical treatment for their children or go on a public taxpayer supported program. Payment for early intervention for children with autism saves money in the long run. One example is a study from Ontario that found that expanding intensive behavioral intervention to all eligible children younger than six resulted in a savings to the government of over $45 million. In Minnesota, even if only 10% of the children treated were to recover to the point that they could be mainstreamed with their typical peers in school without additional special education services, the lifetime savings would be nearly $1 billion. Hope can be a powerful tool. While we do not want to give false hope that every child with autism will be indistinguishable from their typical peers, we can assert that with effective early intervention and treatment and with ongoing supports, families can experience an improvement in functioning in their child, and society can benefit from the inclusion of what these and other children with disabilities have to offer. The treatment and management of children with autism is a joint societal responsibility. For too long, we've been bouncing these children and families like hot potatoes from mental health to developmental disabilities, to education, to social services, to private and public insurance. Requiring private insurance coverage will not be the total answer, as we must review and protect what we have in medical assistance and other public payer systems. Still, private insurance has a role, and it is our belief that if all plans were required to provide coverage, then the burden would be equally shared. Considering the long-term benefit of effective treatment, isn't this modest investment worth it? Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, I'm looking at the handout you gave with the cost of the insurance at 31 cents, looks like per individual that has insurance. My first question is, you have year of coverage number two, so tell me what it was in the first year.
What you're referring to is the information from Autism Speaks. I don't have that information off the top of my head. I don't know if it's in the chart itself. I think the idea was that the first year there would be an unmet need and there would be an increase in that first year. But once it had settled out, it would drop. Let's see, do we have the...
So, Madam Chair, if I can just get clarification.
Yeah.
So you're saying that's all claims related to the autism in the second year that the legislation was in place. Is that what you're trying to say this is?
Mr. Bachman.
Yes, that's what the Autism Speaks information reveals. Again, I don't want to get too hung up on the 31 cents because different states have different requirements. It might be more in Minnesota. It might be less.
Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, I just have a couple other questions related to that and those other states. Did they put a cap on age? In other words, was it more focused
right.
on the youth? And secondly, did they generally limit the number of hours? And the reason why I'm asking those two questions is the bill before us, there's no cap on age, and there's apparently unlimited hours. And you know, we do have to wrestle with the cost versus the benefit. To me, it appears that there is a benefit, but I want you to address those two parts.
Mr. Bachman.
Yes, you're correct, Senator. Some of those states actually did impose caps and limits. And so, again, that's why I indicated in my testimony, every state is different in how they would structure that. But even with no cap, it's our contention that the PMPM cost would be less than a dollar.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add that I've already discussed this with the chair of the Finance Committee, and he's well aware that he's going to have to figure out what he can afford when this gets to him. I don't know enough about it to make that decision. So I'm going with the policy piece right now.
Thank you, Senator. Did you have
Madam Chair, if we could take one
testimony?
More testifier for
okay.
a moment and then turn it over.
I'd like to call up
Joe Mose as our next testifier. Joe is a living proof of what intensive early ABA therapy can produce in terms of a functioning taxpayer.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Joe Mose. And I have come here today in support of the autism treatment insurance mandate because I know from personal experience that appropriate treatment provided at an early age can greatly increase the chances of improvement and maybe independent living. I was diagnosed myself when I was 24 months old, and in my case, it was so severe that I could not speak or give eye contact. I would spend most of my time staring at the wall or flapping my hands. The child psychiatrist who placed the diagnosis warned that I would be living in an institution by the time I turned 10. This real-life worst-case scenario is why I find myself blessed to be part of a devoted family who sacrificed so much to help increase my odds of living a stable, productive life, especially when insurance coverage for autism treatment was non-existent. All expenses were paid out of pocket. After 13 months of traveling the country to consult the most respected experts in the field of child psychiatry and autism, my parents discovered, by pure chance, a treatment method that would eventually result in my recovery. I was one of the first participants of the LOVOS Applied Behavioral Analysis Program at UCLA after its study was completed in 1987. If I was any older than I was when I began the program, I would not be the same person I am today. The hours of therapy were long and hard, but it didn't end in the clinic. In addition to the 40-hour week in the clinic, my mom, who learned LOVOS therapy quickly, taught it to me with the same energy and passions as the therapists on campus. Getting myself to look at the therapist in the eyes was the most difficult skill to learn, but afterwards, I responded to this treatment so well that I completed the program by 8 months. By the time I entered kindergarten, I was mainstream into the school system without the need of an assisting aid, and since then, I have graduated with a Bachelor of Fine Arts at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and I now work for a respected IT company, and it should also be stated again that I am a taxpayer. I know that I am not the only one who can benefit from this remarkable therapy. I have met many people affected by autism who have led to live successful lives. Between the times I've received treatment and today, over half of the states of the Union have passed this insurance mandate, which has granted access for autism treatment to thousands of families that would not have been able to afford it otherwise. Our time to join this reoccurring trend has been well overdue. Minnesota provides the best health care in the country, and coverage is given to treatment for every disease and disorder imaginable. Why ignore autism? The average cost to take care of a child with low-functioning autism is $3 million. This mandate will be a relief on our budget, but most important, it will give our children affected by autism to build a future. Treatment, no matter how intensive therapy may be, does not guarantee fast improvement or recovery. But to be given the chance to live a successful, independent life is far greater than no chance at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great job. Mr. Mose, for your testimony.
Any questions for us? Otherwise, there are some people waiting to speak.
Sure. I have on my list Bob Johnson.
Or do I have to do the other ones?
And Mike Hickey.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead,
Bob Johnson,
Mr. Johnson.
Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll be brief because I know the committee time is very short. We are opposed to House File 314. I'd like to just follow up and maybe make one point. I know there's some business reps here that want to address the issue of the cost because mandates do cost money. But I'd like to ask the committee to consider the following. A week ago, you acted on a bill, Senate File 662, chief authored by Senator Lori, that dealt with the issue of bringing the exchange rules into the non-exchange market. Very, very significant issue. And this committee actually amended that bill to take out Article 2 and to put it into a study. In other words, don't bring the exchange rules into the non-exchange market. And so why am I bringing that up? For the following reason. You have to look at health coverage mandates today in light of what the ACA does. It's different today. And here's how it's different. If this legislature enacts this coverage mandate under the Affordable Care Act, coverage mandates passed after December 31st, 2011, coverage mandates passed after December 31st, 2011,
if they are not an essential health benefit, are the financial obligation of the state. So in other words, so this is after December 31st, 2011, this is not an essential health benefit. So under the ACA, the Minnesota legislature passing this or any other coverage mandate, it's the state's financial responsibility to pay for that. I know there's a fiscal note, and I haven't been able to go through it. I'm aware it's been put together, whatever the dollars are on that. So that's the first thing. But then the second thing, under the ACA and the current rules that are being promulgated, and every committee member here has probably heard scores of people come to this table and comment on the challenge of trying to sort through the complexity and the difficulties of seeing the implementation of the Affordable Care Act at the end of this year. But here's what it does do. So under the Affordable Care Act and the law I just cited to you, the state will pay for this coverage for qualified health plans in the exchange and qualified health plans outside of the exchange, but the state will not pay for the cost of this coverage mandate for non-qualified health plans outside of the exchange. And I just want to urge the committee, this is going to add to the market inequity. And I think this committee was concerned about the uncertainty about what's going to be happening this fall and as we turn the corner. But we do know that for a fact. If this legislature passes this, qualified health plans will be reimbursed for the costs of this in the exchange and outside. Non-qualified health plans will not. And it's just an inequity. It's going to exacerbate. It's going to hurt the customers of those companies outside. And under the ACA, you do not need to be a qualified health plan. It fully anticipates non-qualified health plans. And that's who's likely going to be selling, who will be selling outside of the exchange. And if the exchange is going to cover 30% of the market or so, that means 70% is not in. And so, Madam Chair, I'll stop with that. It's just it's an inequity. It's the reality of the federal law, and there's nothing that this committee or the legislature can do about that. And it's going to cost shift or onto a group of customers in a very unfair way, and you can't stop that. By passing the coverage mandate, that will be the result if this is passed by the legislature. So I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, can you address the insurance cost aspect? They gave a number of 31 cents per person. Do you have any estimate from the insurance side of it, your perspective?
Madam Chair and Senator Gazelka, if I could defer, I know there's some other representatives here from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans who would be probably better able to answer your question.
That's Mike Hickey. Thank you. I have Mike Hickey.
Madam Chair, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the largest representative of small business in the state with 13,000 members, and virtually all our members are impacted by what the state's doing in our small group market and with the exchange and everything else. Just wanted to make some brief comments. We understand what a dire issue this is for the families that have struggled with it and how people do need to seek additional treatment and additional help. But I think you have to be very aware of the cost. We looked into this a few years ago and the legislature was considering it. This is the most expensive mandate we've ever seen. And what we did is we compared it to the cost of maternity. And the average cost of maternity a few years back at one of the major clinics in town was between $10,400 and $16,000 for median cost. That's not including prenatal and postnatal. The average cost for Blue Cross, when they had a benefit they offered very similar, almost identical to this legislation, was $30,000 on average with a high of $100,000. So someone's talking about 31 cents per person per whatever. This is not 31 cents per whatever. This is $30,000 to $100,000. Mr. Johnson did a good job of describing who's going to pay and when the state has to pay and when small employers have to pay. And clearly we're going to have to pay when our members are not in qualified health plans, and we'll have to see all that shakes out in the next year or two as we go through this huge transformation with the ACA. But this is the most expensive mandate we've ever seen, and you need to be aware of it. We're very concerned that CGIP and MA have been exempted for this. Why? Because it's too expensive. But we're going to put it on the backs of small employers who are struggling with dramatic, and some of them are struggling with huge cost increases due to all the fallout from the ACA and the way that's imposed itself across the 50-state market. So why are we exempting them? Because it's too expensive, but we're going to go ahead and pass this on small business. So understand what a difficult issue this is for the people and the families that deal with it, but we just can't afford any more. Between the ACA and what's gone on with the health insurance exchange bill, that alone is 6.1% in new assessments. When you look at the 3.5 ultimate assessment and the other additional ACA assessments, you just look at everything. We just can't afford anymore. Just can't do anymore. We can't pile more things on the backs of small businesses, and urge you to really take a second and third look at this, and we just can't afford it. Thank you.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eaton, do you know how many people have children have autism in Minnesota? I'm just trying to calculate numbers. If we took Blue Cross's numbers of 30,000 times, you know, the number of people that might benefit from this care.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The number I have on the sheet is there are 1,000 8-year-olds classified with autism, and that was from 2008. I don't know if we have anything.
8-year-olds. Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, we do have more extensive numbers here that I will provide to you, but Senator Eaton is correct. That's the number that, and one of the handouts there, the colored one, has some graphs and charts. So I will, we will provide you with those numbers. I would simply say to Mr. Hickey, by the way, that it is 31 cents per member per month. That's what the dollar recommend, what the studies show in other states that have imposed this cost. And from the public point of view, if the health plans carry their fair share in their burden and absorb or pass on that 31 cents per member per month, the cost to the public goes down. That's what the essence of this bill is, has to do with. So Mr. Hickey is whether it gets passed on or not to his folks, that'll the competitive marketplace will determine that. But we think that's a modest cost to include in the benefit a number of people that, as Mr. Hickey even suggested, are desperately in need of that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the information I was given here is that the Minnesota schools reported there were 15,378 individuals that have met the educational criteria for autism spectrum disorder that were receiving special ed, and that's between the ages of 0 and 20.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Hickey.
I just wanted to include that this 31 cents estimate is just irrelevant. Blue Cross did this mandate, and it was $30,000 average cost, and as high as hundreds. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not 31 cents per whatever.
Okay, we have one more testifier, and we have about 5 minutes.
Okay.
So, Kate Johansson. Oh, I guess we'll have... Okay. If you can state your name for the record.
Yes, sorry about that. My name is Idil Abdul. I have autistic son who's 10 years old. And as you can see, I'm the only minority here. And so I'm also an autism advocate. And I advocate usually for low-income minority children who, as you know, always get the short end of the stick of any health equality. And I am a member of the Minnesota Autism Task Force, nominated by Speaker Zeller's last session. I'm also the member of the Federal Advisory Autism that advises, that was nominated by the Obama administration and Kathleen Sebelius. And at the risk of sounding arrogant, we are opposed to this for many reasons. On this Federal Autism Advisory Committee, I'm the first African-American, I'm the first Minnesotan, and I'm the only one from the Midwest states. And the people on this committee are directors of NIMH, NIH, NIEH, CDC, et cetera. And no one recommends an unlimited hours of applied behavior analysis. None of the 32 states that have it recommended. And as you can see, I brought in a list of states that have medical assistance, because my job as a black woman is always fighting for the guy whose faces are not shown here, whose voices are not heard here. And the states, according to CMS, that have MA coverage, it is not unlimited hours. There is no science. Is there science for early intervention for a child's early years? Yes. In fact, yesterday in the Federal Advisory Committee, and if somebody can pass that along, I brought the list of the states that have MA coverage, and I brought the list of the number of children that have autism in Minnesota. And a letter that we wrote yesterday to Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, we recommended that public insurance and private insurance do pay for autism early intensive therapy in early, meaning child's early years. Should we throw away children that are after they're 7 or 6? No. But as someone who sits next to NIMH and NIEH and you know, all the federal government directors, there is simply no science for this unlimited hours of ABA. And if somebody wants to look at, people were asking the cost. The Minneapolis Tribune did a story about this, and I think I've emailed to all of you, that it can cost as high as $100,000 per child per kid. When the person who's going to prescribe the therapy is not objective, it's the person who owns the clinic. And I always give the example, if you're a shoe shiner at the airport and somebody says you can prescribe to anybody that walks by, everybody that walks by, you're going to say that person needs a shoe shine, that person needs a shoe shine. So the idea that it's not going to have a balance of checks, the idea that's going to eliminate and discriminate against children that are low income, that are disproportionately minorities, it breaks my heart. Just yesterday was Council of Black Minnesotans Day lobby, and everybody of both parties came to us and they said, we know that African-American and Latino children are behind in health disparities. We want to make sure that we tackle it. We want to make sure that we eradicate disparity. And the one way to do that is making sure that equal opportunities is there. So if people are going to mandate and dictate private companies to pay for services, they better be willing to pay for the children that are low income, that have Medicaid. I urge you to amend this to put age appropriate. I urge you to amend this to put cost-effective way, because you cannot afford it. And just so you know, Madam Chair and members, there are about 3 or 4 states, 2 states for sure, Florida and Washington State, where private insurance passed and low-income families sued the state because, and a judge ruled in favor and said the state will have to pay for that. So if anybody's thinking, let's just pay those blood-sucking insurance companies, let's make sure they pay for it. I don't know if I could say that.
You did.
Sorry. I slipped out. I'm sorry.
Okay.
If we say that, we're going to make sure the private insurance companies pay for it and not so much for the low-income medical assistance child, I guarantee you the low-income families will sue. Now, in conclusion, okay. in interest of time, I see I'm reading your body language. Governor Dayton, to his credit, after we have been on him like white on rice, he did say that we're going to cover autism coverage, but it has a limit, $12 million. The legislation, Senate File 314, the sky's the limit for the private insurer. So if I'm a provider, right, I'm in the business of making money, as good as a compassionate as I am. I'm not going to take the child who has the cap, $12 million for the low-income kid, the unlimited, the private insurance, upper-middle-class child, the sky's not even the limit. That is not the America I immigrated. That is not the America you are from. The America that I imagine is equal for all.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this? Kate's coming up now. Kate Johansson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employer members, 80% of which are small businesses. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Certainly, while sympathetic to the concerns of proponents of this bill, the Chamber unfortunately opposes Senate File 314 because it's incongruent to our overall state goals of ensuring that people have access to affordable health insurance. Our opposition is rooted in a few simple tenets. First, this is a new mandated benefit, and as a result, consumers will pay more for their insurance. This is a problem because Minnesota already has one of the highest numbers of mandated benefits of any state in the country. We have 64 mandated benefits on our books, and it makes insurance more expensive for only one group, and that's fully insured consumers, the individuals who are your constituents and the small businesses that provide jobs and sustain jobs in your local communities. Certainly, that's an issue also because each of these mandated benefits, according to the Congressional Budget Office, which I think we can assume is a fairly neutral source, say that a new mandated benefit usually increases the cost of a premium about 1%. This could not come at a worse time to add more cost to health insurance. As noted by previous testifiers, we have a 2% increase looking from the federal ACA premium tax. We have up to a 1.5% increase from the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange coming in 2014 and up to a 3.5% premium tax, again, all on fully insured consumers coming in 2015 and thereafter. We have a 3% MCHA assessment coming on small businesses in 2014, and this is on top of regular health inflation and all the other taxes and fees and assessments that fully insured consumers already pay. Second, this is a particularly troublesome mandate because it is particularly expensive. We've seen this in the 2011 MCHA study that said 70 patients cost that pool about $4 million at just one treatment facility. The National Council on State Legislatures, another neutral and well-cited and bipartisanly cited source, says that autism mandates generally cost more between 1 and 3% of premium because the incidence of autism and its prevalence is rising and because the cost of treatment is so high. Third, we do know that there will be a state cost in this. The House bill already has a $22 million fiscal note, and that does not incorporate all of the costs that this bill will implicate. It's related to the policy, as Mr. Johnson said, that you considered in Senate File 662 last week. And certainly, as there is so much change in health care right now and health insurance, we want to look at all of these things as a piece and how they'll impact small businesses and consumers in the fully insured market as a whole. Another point is that this really is not a particularly proven therapy. We see in the 2009 state fiscal note from Minnesota Management and Budget that they note that the effectiveness of this particular treatment is, quote, undetermined and may not be cost effective. Again, when the state looks at providing health coverage and the goals that we want to pursue, cost effectiveness should be among the top when we look at achieving the triple aim. And finally, I would just note that this is not necessarily a required or necessary coverage. Every commercial product in Minnesota already provides coverage for autism, and there are options for consumers, and flexible treatments might be found best between patients and their providers. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Excuse me, I've forgotten your name. What?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, my name is Kate Johansson.
Kate Johansson. Madam Chair and Ms. Johansson, what percent of the Chamber's membership insurance already covers this?
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, I'm not familiar with the exact insurance plans, but what I can tell you is, as I mentioned, 80% of our members are small businesses. We define that as under 100 members. Those are the groups most likely to purchase fully insured products. All fully insured products in Minnesota have some form of autism coverage at this time. So I'm not sure what specific coverages they would have, but they do all have the option to shop for coverages that suit their needs and their employees' needs.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add that there is some work being done with the governor and CMS. Hopefully we can get it as an essential benefit, but we do not know. It's a long shot. We are trying for that. The other piece is that no matter how much you restrict insurance, people still get ill, and then we all pay for it on our property tax and our income tax. It happens. If we don't spread it around, this is a real concern in the community. People are losing their financial well-being because of the illness of their children, which anyone would understand that you would go to the ends of the earth to pay for it. And likely, what will happen is most will migrate to the public programs, and so we'll be paying for it under our public health care.
Senator Carlson?
I guess I want to follow up on a couple of points where I was making here. You mentioned numbers of businesses, but I think that you often quote the number of employees that are represented. And I guess I would like to know how many employees have the benefit of this level of autism coverage, of insurance that covers autism and the ABA specifically.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, that's not information that the Chamber collects, but certainly I would be happy to see if our members would be interested in sharing that information with you.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, and I guess what the statement I'd like to make is that you don't represent those people who already have this coverage and have it available to cover their children. And I guess when you say it's not a proven therapy, I'm wondering if you did see the testimony of Mr. Mohs. Did you see that testimony that he's a living example of it working?
Mrs. Johansson.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, certainly I did, and I've heard Mr. Mohs testify before and really enjoyed hearing him testify again, and I'm delighted to see him enjoying the taxpayer lifestyle with me. But I would also note that my description of the therapy as unproven is based on two sources. First, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which has consistently rated this particular therapy as based on poor evidence. And second, the state's own fiscal note from 2009, in which a similar provision in the omnibus bill was noted as citing this therapy as having undetermined effectiveness, and that it may not provide cost-effective treatment for the state.
Ask you. Senator Carlson.
Yeah, and yes. I guess I think I've spoken to some parents, Madam Chair, and Ms. Patterson. I've spoken to some parents that have said that their children have come out of the designation of being autistic because of this therapy. And I think that the notion of proven versus non-proven seems to me to be pretty obvious that it's already been proven in many instances. And then I guess I'd like to follow up with, being from representing business, I think you understand the concept of return on investment. And it seems like this, we even have some numbers here of $100,000 being invested in getting a $3.2 million payback to the public. That seems to me to be an awfully good ROI, that there's almost nothing we can put money into that gives that kind of a return on investment.
Okay.
And I guess I'd like to see if there's anything else you're doing that has that kind of an ROI.
Mrs. Johansson.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, I have not been presented with the information prior to today's testimony, but what I do know is that, yes, businesses do make decisions on cost effectiveness. The state has said that this is not a cost effective therapy. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality has rated the evidence relating to this therapy as poor. And at the end of the day, what we do know is that there's at least a $22 million fiscal note to this bill in the House that does not include, as Mr. Johnson cited earlier, the impact of relating this on top of the essential health benefits, so the state will have to bear the cost of the mandate. And certainly I am sympathetic to the anecdotal evidence that you're referencing, but unfortunately at the end of the day, legislators are left with the task of determining whether you want to make policy based on anecdote or evidence, and I don't envy you that task, but I'm basing my testimony on the evidence presented.
I would like to recommend to the committee that for your consideration, this would move forward to health, and it would also be in health finance. I would make the recommendation that we refer it out of this committee without recommendation, and it would go to the health committee.
Somebody else has to make that motion.
I'm sorry, someone else has to make that motion. I've been told.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Senator Carlson.
I will make the motion that Senate File 314 be recommended or be sent without recommendation to health finance.
Health policy. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Good job, Vicki. We are
Meeting adjourned.